Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey will be back next week. Coming up, economic insecurity afflicts more than 7 out of 10 blacks and nearly half of all Americans. And the Occupy movement hooks up with black ministers to occupy the dream. But first, the Congress has once again banned government-funded abortions in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Constitution gives Congress exclusive rights over the nation's capital, but that doesn't make it right, according to Anise Jenkins of the Stand Up for Democracy in D.C. Coalition.
Now, we know the Constitution said a lot of things that we disagree with, including the fact that as a black woman, I would be still pulling cotton and not be able to vote. But that's the reason we're in this situation right now. D.C. is not a state.
Now, the Congress has on several occasions banned government-funded abortions in D.C.
Just back in April, that was the deal that kept the government open that time. Our president and the Congress decided that D.C. citizens' rights were extendable and could be used as a bargaining chip, and those were the same issues, the right to abortion for low-income women and needle exchange, and I think they even threw in school vouchers, which we had rejected, to sweeten the deal.
Congress is constantly forcing its political experiments on D.C., isn't it?
Constantly. What they do, you have conservatives on both sides of the aisle who decide this may help them, playing with D.C., using us, playing the games on D.C. will help them get reelected at home. They can say that they have a majority black jurisdiction, liberal, progressive, which votes predominantly Democrat, in line. They can say that and go home and run on that platform. And it's our opinion, when you're saying that a place that has the HIV/AIDS rate of Haiti, that you can't use your local funds for needle exchange, they are really riding our backs into the grave. They could care less if we live or die.
Many people don't understand that D.C. taxes its citizens for its own programs. It comes up through its own legislature with its own programs, but the federal government gets to treat D.C.'s tax money as its own.
Yes, that's correct. Congress uses D.C. as its experimental canary in the mine. These are local funds. These are funds that were approved and passed by our local democratically elected council, which we do have, and Congress can just wipe it out. Our council passes our budget, and it's been approved and signed by the mayor. It goes to Congress, and Congress has a 30-day layover to absolutely change it, to stop it, to delay it, or to add whatever they want to it. And it's an international disgrace. We're the only jurisdiction in the country that has to suffer this oppression. And it is oppression because this deals with our everyday life. It deals with our health care, our education. It's not just a game. It's not just talking about can we vote. It's talking about our lives.
Your organization, Stand Up for Democracy in D.C. Coalition, is also called Free D.C. What does D.C. need in order to be free?
We need the right to begin with, just basic rights of citizenship, that we should be able to determine our local laws. We should be able to say, yes, we have a high HIV/AIDS rate, so we do need needle exchange. Yes, we do have people suffering from diabetes and glaucoma, so yes, we should have medical marijuana. That's basically what we're asking for. It's nothing radical about this. We're just asking for basic citizenship rights, and really, we're tired of asking, and we've gotten into the mode of demanding. Stand Up for Democracy is a continuation of the Free D.C. movement that came up from Mississippi back in the 60s. And we are demanding, we're protesting. We just had three young men who are on a hunger strike who have decided that they are not going to take it anymore. We had our mayor arrested. We're just not taking it. We're not accepting this treatment.
The most prominent resident of D.C. is the Democratic president. But, of course, Democrats joined with Republicans in curtailing abortions in D.C. You would think that the Democratic president would have some influence over those other Democrats.
I think he does, too. But I think he was willing, as he was in April, to sell us out. And it's a tremendous disappointment. D.C., as I said, is overwhelmingly Democrat. President Obama got over 90% vote when he ran for president. It's almost a joke. Does he expect us to continue to vote for him because he thinks we have no alternative? No, that's not going to happen. People are disappointed. I've had his campaign, local campaign, calling me and asking me to come in. And I told them very bluntly that our president has the power to change this. And we want him to speak out. We can't continue to support him and he doesn't support us. It can't happen. I would like to add that our delegate, our non-voting delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, has introduced H.R. 265, which is to make D.C. the 51st state. Statehood is what we need. That will give us the constitutional protection from the oppressors on the Hill. And we're asking people to write their congressperson, their senators, state legislature, anyone they can influence to support H.R. 265.
That was Anise Jenkins in Washington, D.C. The Occupy Wall Street movement has made an alliance with at least some elements of the Black Church. Reverend Jamal Bryant made the announcement at a press conference in Washington.
Today we are mapping out change from Washington, D.C. to New York to Oakland, California, that we are occupying until poverty is completely eradicated. Robert Kennedy said, as long as there is plenty, poverty is evil. As a consequence, ladies and gentlemen, we are surrounded by a lot of evil because there is a lot of poverty. In 1967, a year before Dr. King's assassination, he released a book entitled, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. He declared on the very last page of that book that the curse of poverty has no justification in our age. The time has come for us to civilize ourselves by the total, direct, and immediate abolition of poverty. That time, ladies and gentlemen, is now. Dr. King died trying to organize the Poor People's Campaign. And Occupy Wall Street, as a consequence, has picked up the mantle that was dropped on at the balcony of the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. For Dr. King was working tirelessly, arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder, with the sanitation workers who could not even find economic parity. So where we were at that time is exactly where we are in this time. What you have seen grow organically from the beginning of just a Facebook posting to now people squatting and protesting, crying out for economic justice, is the echoing of the refrain that was issued by Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, that we're just sick and tired of being sick and tired. The Black Church, as a consequence, cannot afford to sit on the sidelines, but must be on the front line of this fight for justice. Occupy Wall Street woke up the world to see that poverty does not just have a Black face, it just does not have a Latino face, but poverty now has a tear-stained American face. And every fabric, every sector, every corner of our country is being impacted in large measure by the gross inequity that is happening from Wall Street to Main Street. And so today, ladies and gentlemen, the Black Church, which has been the incubator and the crib of civil rights within this country, now joins in lockstep with Occupy Wall Street so that the world will understand that poverty is not known to any ethnicity, to any gender, to any zip code, but it has in fact amassed itself in a record number souring way that all of us understand that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so you may not realize it because none of the people who are before you today have on fatigues or boots or wearing helmets, but we are in the middle of a war against poverty. We're at war, but we are in a nonviolent war against poverty as conscientious objectors to corruption and greed, armed with patriotism and with values, with goals and with families. We are at war, ladies and gentlemen, because 1% of this country controls 2/3 of the economy. were at war because chief executives of Fortune 500 companies earned 110 times that which its employees make. We are at war because the top 1% has watched their income grow up by 250% in the last 15 years. We are at war because the UN disclosed in 2009 that the United States of America, one of the richest places on the planet, is now third in economic distribution. We are at war because we're having to question if, in fact, the government is run for the people and by the people, when the average representative household represents an income of $912,000, when the average citizen who is a part of the 99% is only earning $31,248. We are at war. We're at war because it is etched in our minds that we cannot continue to go down this slippery slope that we're presently on. Because the credit stating that the American country is now in mirrors the stained and deteriorated credit stating of so many Americans who cannot afford to get a loan, start a business, buy a car, or even move into a home. For so long and for so many, 9/11 has been etched into our minds as the day in which we saw the Twin Towers go down. But there will be a new day that America will not soon forget, not 9/11, but 1/16. On 1/16, the revolution will begin to go into overdrive, where the black church will begin to occupy the dream as well as occupy Wall Street. And so you will see, from New York all the way to Oakland, California, people of Latino descent, those who are African American, Native American, Caucasian Americans, Jewish Americans, all standing together saying that this is the time that the dream must come to pass. Just a few feet from where it is that I presently stand, the memorial of Dr. King was in fact unveiled. And so on January 16th, when the nation recognizes his birthday, it is a reminder for all of us that Dr. King did not die for a monument. He died for a movement. And the movement cannot sit still, but the movement has got to move forward. We're calling every place of worship, every association, every fraternity, every sorority, every community organization, any person who cares about the future of this country and the future of your children, to know that there is, in fact, a possibility that your children will, in fact, be the first generation of Americans who will live beneath the standard of their parents. So on January the 16th, 1/16, we occupy the dream. We occupy the dream, and we are, in fact, given absolute clarity, because the question has been asked, what does Occupy want? We want just what the Constitution promised. A Constitution promised that there is, in fact, the ability to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We've been unable to do that, but on 1/16, we occupy the dream, asking with all of the other economic inequities, three critical things must take place. The very first thing that we're asking for is a complete strengthening of Pell Grants, because we want our young people to have an opportunity for higher education. Because it is that they have, in fact, trained themselves and prepared themselves, they must have that opportunity to educate themselves. The Pell Grant must not, in fact, be a negotiable option. When we talk about the strengthening of America, can we compete on a global stage? It is not enough for us to just be able to compete in athleticism, but we must be able to compete in intellectual strength. The second thing, ladies and gentlemen, that we're going to be asking for is an immediate moratorium on foreclosures. While it is that I'm yet standing, there are 18.3 million vacant houses that 36 to 48 months ago were, in fact, occupied. But because of predatory lending, they are empty. We're asking for an immediate freezing on all foreclosures until there's been a complete Senate hearing so that we can talk about the predatory lending and practices that have taken place that have eroded the core and the construct of our country and its citizens. Thirdly, we're asking Wall Street directly for $100 billion, $100 billion for economic development, for job training, for entrepreneurship. Many of the jobs in which our parents were a part of have now been outsourced to other places and have no intentions of ever coming back.
As a consequence, these companies owe a debt to the citizens that made them the wealthy entity that they are on today. So $100 billion is a drop in the bucket. We're asking every hamlet, every community, every suburb, every inner city, on 116, it is not a holiday to take off, but it is the day that we come on board, that we occupy the dream, and we occupy Wall Street to Main Street. We are, in fact, going to be converging in strategic cities across this country with a visual symbol, asking those who will participate to bring crutches, chairs, wheelchairs, walkers, and even canes and casts to be left at Federal Reserve banks and banking institutions in their communities at the door to symbolize that the American people have become handicapped by the economy. Handicapped because we can't pursue our dreams, we can't chase after our goals, and we cannot hold on to the promise that the American Constitution has given us. So on 116, Occupy the Dream is in fact occupying Wall Street. These are not two separate entities, but we are walking together under one umbrella, under one doctrine, under one principle, and that very simple doctrine is liberty and justice for all. Thank you so much.
Reverend Jamal Bryant is pastor of the Empowerment Temple AME Church in Baltimore, Maryland. He's a former national youth director of the NAACP. David DeGraw is among the founding circle that put together the Occupy Wall Street movement. He joined black ministers at the press conference.
The Occupy Wall Street movement is about people coming together to say enough is enough. Our families have endured economic oppression for too long. The Occupy Wall Street movement draws its strength from people of all different walks of life with opinions across the political spectrum, coming together to find common ground and unite against the global financial interests that have bought control of our government. Dr. King's vision of economic justice is an edifying example of what we intend to achieve. The Occupy movement has become a powerful force by occupying communities throughout the country. The time has now come for us to embody the spirit of Dr. King and for us to occupy the dream. We are proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with the African American faith community in this campaign for economic fairness and justice. We are all in this fight together. We all want a healthy and secure future for our families. In the absence of a government that will defend us and represent us, we are now taking it upon ourselves to stand up and defend our own families. It is a great honor today to join with the spirit of Dr. King, to join with the heroes of the civil rights movements, luminaries of the faith community, pioneers in music, and all of you in attendance here today. It is a great honor today to announce the birth of the Occupy the Dream movement. This statement was made by something about like 30 Occupy Wall Street organizers. I will have a list of those once I can weed them all out of my email inbox later today. Before passing the mic over, I just want to say that I was very excited to hear that on January 16th, we're going to be occupying Federal Reserves. I can't speak for the whole movement, of course, but people that I've worked with for a while now have focused on demonstrating against the Federal Reserve. And this has been a central factor in building what was the 99% movement is now Occupy Wall Street. We had protests in the past, also at Zuccotti Park in June. And when we went there, we had Awal Mubarak. Awal Mubarak was Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. So to see that Occupy the Dream is starting much the way we did is fantastic, and it couldn't be more perfect. So I will happily join you, and I will rally the troops.
Thank you.
To get to the Federal Reserve on January 16th. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
David DeGraw, Dr. Ben Chavis is a key actor in Occupy Movement's new outreach effort. Chavis is a former political prisoner, a one-time executive director of the NAACP, and a co-chairman, along with media mogul Russell Simmons, of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network. Chavis responded to a local Washington newspaper reporter who questioned why blacks should make alliances with Hispanics.
When Dr. King articulated the dream, it was inclusive.
Come on.
The beloved community. You know, and I'm so glad you asked that question because I'm going to be writing for a paper that our community reads. It is in our interest to build coalitions beyond ourselves.
That's right.
You, in fact, that is what the beauty of what today represents. You know, we're not trying to achieve economic equality and leave others in economic inequality. If you for justice, you gotta be justice for everybody.
That's right.
If you want economic equality, you gotta be it for everybody. But I know what the sister is asking. So many of us in the African American have gotten into a situation where it is a major challenge because we are the most unemployed, we are the most disproportionately incarcerated. And to some extent, the hopelessness maybe manifests the most in our community. That's why I'm so thankful that Black church leaders are responding. We know how to raise people's expectations and inspiration, and also to channel that into something that people can participate in their own resurrection, their own empowerment. So, Valencia, this is not going to be easy. You know, movement building is not easy. Social change is not easy. Our Wall Street brothers and sisters occupied have always shown us that just to get the attention of Americans was not easy. A lot of people went to jail. A lot of people suffered. A lot of people have given up their livelihood to call attention to this problem of economic inequality and income inequality. So we're going to work on it. And we realize it's going to be a struggle. That's our history.
Dr. Ben Chavis of Occupy the Dream. In North New Jersey, the People's Organization for Progress is 6 months into a 381-day marathon of daily demonstrations. POP is demanding jobs, adequate education, housing, justice, and peace, and vows to match the duration of the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott. Adrian Taylor is an activist with the Communications Workers Union.
The issues that POP is fighting about are issues of working people or people who would like to be working people. You know, that's the travesty of it. You know, we have unemployment up to the gills. It's not because people don't want to work. I have to laugh every time they say, oh, Americans don't want these jobs. Well, you know, another fallacy of 1% of the population.
Now, POP is demonstrating not just for jobs, but also for adequate peace. Housing, for peace.
Let's talk about education. I'm not saying that this president did it, but he is the president. We still have not put these wars in our budget, yet and still we've taken money out of our budget for education. In this country, everybody ought to have the opportunity for more than an adequate education, because we're a rich country. We need to be able to have a really good education. Our children need to be competitive. We have a global economy. Did anybody pay attention? What does that global economy mean to poor people in America? When education is out of the reach of poor people. It's now out of the reach of the middle class. People are taking their children out of private schools, out of colleges and universities, and had to put them into community colleges. Well, there's nothing wrong about going to a community college, but there is something wrong about middle class America not being able to afford a decent education for our children. Something terribly wrong about them, terribly suspect. If we're going to be world leaders, we need to be world educators.
Adrian Taylor in Newark, New Jersey. A new study shows that 62% of African American households are living in economic insecurity, meaning they find it very difficult to meet the basic needs of the family. That also goes for nearly half of all American households. The study was conducted by the organization Wider Opportunities for Women. Donna Adkisson is president. We asked if she was shocked by the findings.
Well, you know, it may be shocking, but I suspect that the average American household already knew this. I really do. We have taken a look at these numbers over and over, really trying to find what it costs for families of different constructions to pay their bills, to make ends meet. And I'm really talking about a baseline, Glenn. We're not talking about even cable television or cell phones. We're talking about what it takes to provide housing, transportation, health care, child care if there are children in the home. Those basic needs that every family has to find the means to afford. And when we compare incomes across the country to that level, we find that way too many families fall below it. As you say, 80%, for example, of black single moms who are working the equivalent of full-time still don't earn enough to get over that line.
That seems to say that we have a crying need for a black woman's movement for economic reasons.
Well, you know, economics of the family, economics in general, are women's issues. We know that women make a lot of the buying decisions in households, if not all of them. But sadly, these folks are having to make choices between basics, between paying the rent or paying for prescriptions, paying for childcare, or paying for gas to go to work. We're really talking about trying to move our nation to a place where the jobs that we are creating, the jobs that we have now, pay a wage that allows families to take care of themselves.
Now, people on the right have been saying a lot lately that poverty is mismeasured in America because it doesn't take into account the fact, as they allege, that poor people have so many gadgets, that they have electronic games and all kinds of things that poor people didn't have before. But your study is not dealing even with cable and other gadgets, if you will, that are actually American necessities if we want to live a socially integrated life.
Well, you know, you raise a very interesting issue because the numbers that we use, that $30,000 figure for one worker, $67,000 for a family of four with two small children in the household, we're talking about housing, we're talking about utilities, we're talking about a food budget and a transportation budget that are bottom line, that meet just the basic needs. And even when we do look at what we would call personal and household items, we're not talking about cable television. We're not even talking about internet access. So we're talking about a level that creates a floor from which we should be able to build a higher quality of life. And as you say, even internet access now is really more of a necessity than a luxury if we're going to apply for those gap-filling public supports, if we're going to apply for employment. In many instances now, we need to be able to do that online. But these budgets that we are using today don't take those kinds of things into account. We can model from here and add those costs in, but more importantly, we just want to shed a bright light on what's really happening with the pocketbooks of American households.
This study shows that to be a single mother in the United States of any race is almost by definition to be the head of an insecure family. Only 18% of single moms head families that are economically secure, and that's only 12% when it comes to African-American single mother-headed families.
Well, and you know, and that's not because these mothers are not working full-time. You know, we're talking about mothers who are working the equivalent of full-time but may not be earning a wage that allows them to pay for the basics. We look at where job growth is occurring. We look at where women are clustered in the workforce. Of the 505 occupations, Glenn, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics tracks, women are clustered. Two-thirds of women are clustered in only 51 of those occupations. And within those occupations, women are getting a discount. We earn significantly less than our male counterparts are, even if we're doing the same job. And that can cost upwards of $10,000 a year, cash on the table, not to mention what it does to our earnings potential across a lifetime, our ability to save for retirement or to accrue even Social Security benefits as we get older. So we have a multi-pronged problem here. We have women who are working full-time, taking care of their families at the same time, but not earning wages that will let them do both.
The report shows that 77% of African American and Hispanic children and 55%, a majority of all children, live in families that are without economic security. This must leave a mark not just on Black America, but on the entire nation's future.
Oh, absolutely, Glenn, without question. We're talking about families that are moving from crisis to catastrophe. That's not something that is generation specific. We do inherit to some extent the economic security or insecurity of our parents. As much as we would like to think that we can be the star, we can go to Hollywood and make a fortune, that just doesn't happen for everyone. In fact, it happens for a very small number. There are some great statistics that I don't have at my fingertips that talk about the percentages of folks who actually are able to move out of the quintile, the percentage of income into which they are born as adults. It just happens very rarely, but I will point to one glimmer of hope. When we look at what happens as education in a household increases, we do see that 32% of households that are headed by Black college grads lack economic security. Only 32% compared to the 75% of households headed by Black high school graduates. So education can make a real difference. It's a good place to start. It's not the only answer. It's not the only thing we need to do, but it's certainly a good place to get moving.
Well, education can make a difference if the jobs are actually out there, the jobs that people are preparing for. But you have some dire statistics on job creation here.
We do. The jobs that are coming into the American market at the moment are low-paying jobs. They for the most part, are in the service sector, in the hospitality sector. We see an uptick in retail, for example, and those jobs are just going to continue. So I think our challenge is going to be not only to diversify the mix of jobs in our economy, but to improve the quality of jobs that we know are going to be with us. We just have to do that.
I don't know if it's part of your mandate to put forward suggestions as to public policy, but this clearly calls for massive federal intervention because the private sector, according to the trends that you're looking at, is not going to provide these opportunities.
There is certainly a very real role for government at all levels, and there is certainly a lot of room for us to talk about public-private partnerships. I think about my life in economic development of old and the importance that government played in being able to provide loan guarantees for business expansion. Even things like job training, Glenn, you know, being able to diversify the kinds of job training offerings that the workforce system offers, being able to embrace the spirit of entrepreneurship that is so intrinsic to the American ideal. Recognizing that we can meet people where they are and we can move them to a place where we're creating our own jobs and starting our own businesses with the skills and the talents that we have right now. That can be a huge job creator for us.
Well, certainly the very nature of what is a living wage must be revised based upon these figures. Obviously, what people thought of as living wages, at least in the public discourse, don't fit the bill, don't cut it.
Well, they really don't. We have depended on the federal poverty level and the poverty measure for so long, but that actually, as you know, grew out of a 1960s research paper where we simply multiplied the cost of food times 3 and established that as a level under which families, individuals were extremely deprived. And we continue to use that level of deprivation to drive policy decisions to determine eligibility for various training programs and other gap-filling public support. So what we're suggesting, and quite frankly, what we have been in conversation with folks in Congress and in the administration about, is developing another measure that really speaks to what it takes to be economically secure, not just define a level under which we are living in abject deprivation. The Census Bureau did take a good first stab at that this year by creating the supplemental poverty measure, but I think that we can do more going forward if we look at what it really costs for childcare, for transportation, for rent, not just what folks are spending.
Donna Atkison, president of Wider Opportunities for Women. Scholar and author Sikivu Hutchinson recently took issue with a New York Times article that portrayed non-religious blacks as marginal to black history and thought. Hutchinson is author of the book Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values Wars. She's also a founder of Black Skeptics of Los Angeles.
In the article, I was really taking issue with the marginalization of African-American secular humanist writers and scholars. And there is a pretty robust body of work around the tradition and legacy of African-American secular humanism that most mainstream folk, African-American, what have you, don't know about. So I found it very egregious that the writer of this particular article on African-American free thinkers and non-believers was not fully honoring and valuing that tradition. And I think that that ties into a broader marginalization of the works and scholarship of non-mainstream, more radical thinkers within the black liberation struggle tradition. There is, as I said, a very rich tradition of the literary lions in African-American culture of the Harlem Renaissance, of certainly the pre-abolition era into the post-abolition era, the post-emancipation era, writing about African-American free thought traditions and, you know, taking issue with the regime of the black church, really unpacking, you know, the intersection of economic disenfranchisement, you know, capitalist exploitation and white supremacy. This is something that is definitely not valued within, let's just say, mainstream, normative, official, academic centers of power in the United States, and I include, you know, African-American studies, you know, within that critique, but absolutely not within, you know, mainstream, you know, journalistic traditions. So I think that particular New York Times article trying to unpack the emergence of an African-American, you know, free thinkers via Facebook and social media and other, you know, online outlets and networks really did a gross disservice to the legacies of critical thought and black liberation struggle, you know, oriented scholarship that looks at all of these intersections.
And you point out that what you call the secular humanist tradition goes back at least as far as Frederick Douglass.
Yes. Apparently, this is a subject of much dissent within African-American free thought circles. You know, this idea that Douglass was not a non-theist, he didn't identify as a non-believer per se. But if we look at the richness of Douglass's critique and deconstruction of the tradition of organized religion, he was definitely a skeptic and a rationalist, and if not a secular humanist, then a more religious humanist. He actively challenged, obviously, the regime of the slaveocracy, of white supremacy, and the way in which, you know, Christianity, you know, was utterly linked to the dehumanization and dispossession of African-American slaves, African-American women, African-American labor. So this is something that, as scholars, we cannot discount with regard to Frederick Douglass's legacy. And this has been extremely uplifting and inspirational for contemporary black secular humanists, because we can look at the ways in which this particular critique really informed African-American human rights and civil rights resistance. And, you know, the mainstream line on African-American human rights and civil rights resistance is that it was theologically based, that that was the premier foundation. But, you know, actually, thinkers as diverse as James Baldwin, as Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, Zora Neale Hurston, Nella Larsen, definitely A. Philip Randolph, James Forman, running the gamut from liberal, progressive to radical, espouse secular humanist views of white supremacy, of economic capitalist exploitation, of women's rights, of imperialism, you know, all of the issues that obviously, you know, beset contemporary African Americans. So this is a legacy that African American secular humanist scholars are, you know, trying to validate in foreground with regard to contemporary political organizing.
And we see the same pattern that tries to root the black freedom movement in the black church, when in fact Martin Luther King and the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, were in fact renegades within the mainstream black church in the South.
Yeah, and you know, we're actively disavowed and demonized by the mainstream, you know, black church organizations, you know, for their radicalism. Particularly King, you know, towards the end of his life, you know, making that critique, again, you know, linking global disenfranchisement and oppression of peoples of African descent and other third world peoples with economic, you know, conditions vis-a-vis, you know, capitalism in the United States and the, you know, regime of white supremacy. So, you know, all of these things are, you know, critically relevant to the way in which contemporary African American communities are being dispossessed. This idea that somehow black theological traditions are the linchpin of black human rights thought in civil rights resistance and political organizing is extremely egregious.
And open black atheists like yourself are shunted to the beyond the pale sector of black thought as far as these critics are concerned.
And I think that this is also part and parcel of the zeitgeist of the United States with regard to this utter hijacking of public morality by the religious right, and the fact that this God fixation, obsession, fetishization has really gripped mainstream African American communities. So that, you know, everywhere you turn, there's an invocation of God and godliness and prayer and wanting to get right with God in order to, you know, somehow redeem one's public morality as a people. So these are trends, and I say trends because, again, referring back to the white religious right's articulation of public morality being linked to godliness, and again, the way in which African-American communities have, unfortunately, you know, fallen under that sway and been co-opted by that. These are trends that African-American atheists, you know, thinkers, writers, and activists are very aware of in attempting to highlight with regard to the whole welter of issues that bedevil contemporary African-American urban communities in particular.
Sakivu Hutchinson, speaking from Los Angeles. She's a frequent contributor to Black Agenda Report. Jared Ball is an editor and columnist at Black Agenda Report and a professor of communications at Morgan State University. He says political prisoners have many more uses to the movement than just as martyrs to the cause, that political prisoners should be valued for their leadership and their expertise.
After this week's rally from Mumia Abu-Jamal in Philadelphia, at which much of the focus was his being removed from death row, at least one thing has again been made clear. Going forward, all movement building must deeply involve the plight of political prisoners. This point was made several ways by several different speakers, including Cornel West, who described the more than 30 years of this particular fight, and Desmond Tutu, who cautioned that the move of Mumia from death row was cool but not a real victory. And who better than a veteran of the freedom struggle in Azania to tell us about incomplete victories? And there was the tireless Ramona Africa, who echoed Tutu's sentiments by acknowledging that not being in solitary confinement was itself no guarantee of safety, and how Mumia's enemies considered this move a close second to actual execution, since he would now be in general population with his own kind, and likely, hopefully, to be killed by one of them. So what was a rally in tribute to Mumia was also a lesson to be learned about the kinds of struggle required, a lesson we can all use at this time of outspoken frustration with the world. There are at least three reasons for aggressively including the politically incarcerated: their experience, their analysis, and the standard they establish for the rest of us. Their experience as conscious actors for liberation, as activists, journalists, and soldiers, needs to be studied and incorporated by emerging campaigners in and out of these occupations. Their analyses, having gone through decades of political struggle, can only help shape the evolving activities here and around the world. And as long as they remain locked up, political prisoners serve as permanent reminders of an absence of real change. especially now as the current president worsens the previously set precedent of denying civil liberties and constitutional rights, and as more and more new initiates to social movement occupy political activity, we need to encourage a renewed focus on the politically incarcerated because we are likely to see those ranks increase. To the first point, political prisoners have tremendous reservoirs of knowledge regarding struggle with the state. They have decades worth of time to reflect on their successes and failures, on what did and did not work, and why. Political prisoners have as much experience with the legal system, the police, the entire apparatus of surveillance and incarceration, all of which is essential knowledge for those now entering political activism for the first time. Mumia has himself penned a number of books, including a recent one dealing particularly with jailhouse lawyering, but simply studying the legal case of any political prisoner becomes a painful and detailed lesson in the function of law. Secondly, the analyses that come out of all this experience are essential. Who better to guide us through the web of radical thought and organization than political prisoners? Who better than they to offer guidance and grappling on an organizational level with issues of race, class, gender, sexuality, and radical implementation of radical theories? And especially for this still largely white occupation effort, there is simply no reason for people like Michael Moore and Naomi Klein to speak on their behalf while Claude Marx, David Gilbert, and Laura Whitehorn are still here. And while these folks should and do speak to the rest of us, we wouldn't do half bad by replacing some of the Dysons, Simmons, and Sharptons with folks like Ashanti Alston, Mutulu Shakur, and Russell Maroon Schultz. And again, lastly, their standard of commitment, action, study, and continued incarceration allows political prisoners to serve even further as liberation guideposts. Let theirs be the standard upon which we determine success and upon which we judge ours or their actions. And let their lack of freedom be genuine reminders of our own. So even in death, former political prisoner Safia Bukhari continues to teach through her work and her legacy. As she said, the issue of political prisoners is part of the movement that we are building, and in building that movement, we must understand that this is not a separate issue. It is an integral part of that movement. It can't be put in the front of the movement, and it can't be an afterthought. It must be woven into the very fiber.
Dr. Jared Ball in Washington. Lawyers for Jamaican dancehall and reggae singer Buju Banton last week appealed his conviction and 10-year sentence on charges of attempting to buy a large quantity of cocaine. Banton, whose family name is Mark Myrie, was caught up in a drug enforcement agency trap set by an informant who's been paid more than $3 million by the agency over the past 10 years. We spoke with Aula Sumbri of the Buju Banton Defense Support Committee. He says the singer is a victim of a government conspiracy.
Buju Banton has a voice that many in conservative positions and are in power would rather see silence than open and free, having access to the ears, hearts, and minds of African people. And this point is something that the Buju Banton Defense Support Committee that we agree on. We understand that he was targeted and that the obvious purpose was to in some way silence or muffle his voice. And this is what we're determined not to see happen. This is why we continue to speak when and where we can, to ask people to remember this brother, to continue to support him by purchasing his music.
Do you think that the government considers Buju Banton to be in some way, shape, or form a national security threat to the United States?
Yes, I do, because I would have to turn my mind off to recent history of African people in America. Somebody's making money off of this. Somebody does not see how a person with a voice like a Buju Banton that they cannot control, they can't see how he could be anything other than the threat.
And in fact, Buju Banton has no criminal record whatsoever.
He has no criminal record whatsoever. The people of Jamaica who know him, the people in the music industry who know him, his priests in London, England, is a member of this committee, Abba Miriam, is a member of the Buju Banton Defense Support Committee. Dr. Carolyn Cooper, a professor of the University of the West Indies, one who has the experience of Buju coming to her to get books about African history so he could better study the history of African people, the plight of African people. She can give a fabulous testimony of how he came to her to get this type of material so that he could be able to give accurate lyrics to the struggle of African people. We now have Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory is a member of the Buju Banton Defense Support Committee.
He's been sentenced to 10 years in jail, and I know that there are concerns for the conditions in which he's incarcerated.
We have been successful in reaching out to the Jamaican embassy, and they did send visitors to where he was being held in Lubbock, Texas, at the Limestone Federal Correctional Facility, which is a substandard facility. The conditions that Buju was being held at in Lubbock, Texas, are inhumane conditions for anybody. But the Jamaican embassy visited there, they saw the conditions, and while we cannot say they forced the government, we can say that he has been moved.
Buju Banton is now incarcerated at a prison near Miami, Florida. Joseph Kabila begins his second term as president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, despite the widespread belief that he stole the recent election. Bahati Jacques is a native of Congo who works with the African Faith and Justice Network in Washington.
The results of the elections are clearly showing that there was fraud. And this fraud is not just any kind of fraud, but it was a stage kind of fraud. And this what is very disturbing about these elections. And we disagree. We disagree, and the international community would and should not recognize these elections.
But it seems these elections and the outcome of these elections have the backing of the United States.
Actually, I'm not sure if the U.S. Is backing these elections. I think what the U.S. is doing, particularly the State Department, they are just being diplomatic, but they understand very well that there was fraud in the elections. The United States Senate held a hearing, which was awesome. And they raise the questions, and they are seeking advice on how they can help the Congo to help the situation that is going really bad. So what they are looking for is ways to negotiate a solution so that the truth can be delivered and the Congolese people's voice can be respected. I believe that the United States is very slow in coming out strong, but I believe they understand that this time around they cannot endorse another fraudulent and rigged election.
How might such negotiations go about? Would we be talking about negotiations between the Kabila regime and the person who came in officially second?
There are many ideas that are being suggested. Some at the hearing suggested that the negotiations be held between parties that are not involved in the rigging of the elections, namely firing the chairman of the Electoral Commission. And at this point, they are also suggesting maybe if the Congolese are willing to get a runoff between Kabila and Tshisekedi, that would be also an idea. Or, practically, this will be what many, at least the Congolese people, are willing to go with, proclaim Tshisekedi the president, because the one who engaged in fraud deserves no trust at all.
And Tshisekedi, of course, is the challenger.
Tshisekedi is the challenger, and I believe he is the one who is favored by the Congolese people, and they are already tired by the leadership of Mr. Kabila, so they really want to see him take the country to a different level.
In Kinshasa, which is a city of 10 million people, opposition to Kabila was quite obvious even to foreign observers.
Yes, the opposition leader Tshisekedi has been always famous and popular in Kinshasa, and actually across the country his name is well known, and when you look at the results, the rest of the opposition candidates really did not even get close to him. That is a clear sign that he's popular. That's why they believe that his chance to become president have been taken away from him, and that they are not willing to let this thing go away and see President Kabila rigged the election. So it is obvious to many people that the most popular at this point and at this time is Tshisekedi more than President Kabila.
And of course, if the Congolese people have a president that has wide public support, that goes a long way towards solving Congo's problems.
In fact, one of the many problems that Congo has been facing, actually this is the major problem, is lack of leadership. When you have a visionary leader, then you can enact policies and make friends internationally and punish those who are criminals within the country. So we believe that if Tshisekedi takes power, probably he might be able to set up strong institutions that would probably bring the country to the next level of being a prosperous country. But the challenges are so many. Personally, I am always reminding the Congolese people to watch out those who are around Tshisekedi, because he is an old man, wise, but he can't do everything by himself. Those who will be surrounding him, working with him, if he get the job, are the one responsible to do most of the work that needs to be done to solve the major challenges that Congo is facing today.
Well, how would Congo's neighbors, I'm talking about the ones who invaded Congo, Uganda, Burundi, and Rwanda, how would they feel about Congo having a popular leader with support from all over the country?
Indeed, the neighboring countries would be very happy to see Kabila continue his leadership, because this is the man who they know and have been working with, and his father cooperated in the invasion. Nations like Rwanda have a cozy relationship with President Kabila, so it is in their best interest. However, that is a short-sighted strategy. Congo is not going anywhere, and these countries are not going anywhere. They will be neighbors forever. So it is in their best interest. It is in the best of interest of the United States as well to diplomatically pressure these countries to say to their friend, President Kabila, that rigging an election is not acceptable and he needs to just step aside and let the Congolese people determine their future. And that anything related to international relations with Congo's neighbors will be just negotiated between them, and there is nothing to be feared.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.